Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives on the Management of Small Cell Lung Cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Stephen Liu from the Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Charlie Rudin from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Today, we're here to talk about small cell. We first wrote the grant to do this program. I didn't realize how much great stuff there was going to be to talk about. But of course, the ASCO meeting was super exciting in terms of lung cancer in general, but particularly small cell. As in all of our work, we will be discussing the use of non-approved regimens and agents. So check out the prescribing information for more. As we've been doing a lot since the pandemic, we went back to our community-based oncologists, asked them to present cases. Today, we have a bunch of cases on small cell and a lot of questions. And of course, a lot of questions about what happened at ASCO. So here's where we're heading. We have eight cases. We're going to see if we can get to, and we'll break it up in the middle with talking about ASCO and other recent publications and presentations relevant to small cell. So just to kind of get warmed up, faculty, we have a few, sort of baseline cases before we kind of get into the new stuff, so to speak. This is a patient who actually had a history of rheumatoid arthritis and angiosarcoma of the scalp and was followed up on imaging and found to have a lung nodule. And here's Dr. Rodriguez talking about what happened.
So very interesting man. He was 73, former smoker, rheumatoid arthritis. He had a new suspicious 1.2 centimeter lung nodule in the right upper lobe. The patient was referred for a robotic bronchoscopy, and they were able to get a diagnosis of this a small cell lung cancer in this tiny lesion in the right upper lobe. So this patient got lucky because we rarely meet patients with stage one small cell lung cancer. He had a PET CT and an MRI of the brain that had no extrathoracic disease. So what to do for this patient? So how often does this happen? Should patients get surgery or chemoradiotherapy? He had like a traditional surgery, not a Welsh resection. We did a lobectomy for him. And all his lymph nodes, he had about 15 lymph nodes removed that were all negative. The only thing that we could technically offer him is adjuvant chemotherapy. And he's still on the fence if he wants to receive it.
So, Stephen, curious when the last time is you saw a case like this, and how do you usually think through management, both local and systemic?
Yeah, I think surgery is the right answer here, but you have to be very careful and make sure these patients are properly staged. I think stage one lung cancer is a lot less common than it seems. In many cases of stage one lung cancer that undergo surgery, end up really being advanced disease that relapses fairly quickly. So you want to be sure patients are thoroughly staged. You're getting a PET scan, an MRI. If there's an abnormal cell line on the CBC, maybe you get a bone marrow biopsy. You really want invasive staging because I do think it's fairly rare. But if this is true stage one, I think surgery is the right answer. And despite the lack of prospective evidence, it's our standard to give adjuvant chemotherapy.
Charlie, anything you want to add to that? And are patients with just local therapy cured? Do you see any of these, or does everybody relapse?
No, there are cures, and I totally agree surgery is the right approach here. If we see an isolated pulmonary nodule that turns out to be small cell, and the patient has appropriate staging done to confirm that, absolutely they should go to surgery, and they need adjuvant chemotherapy. I would certainly encourage that in this case. Only retrospective analyses, but the retrospective analyses that have been done have clearly shown that if you did not get adjuvant chemo, the outcome is much worse. So, but this is a potentially curable situation. The patient needs adjuvant chemo.
So this is like rocket rounds. We're walking down the hall and just kind of throwing a few cases out. And this next case is a patient who actually presented with what was thought to be Eaton-Lambert or Lambert-Eaton syndrome. Got treated, had limited stage disease, got chemo radiation, was the pre-Adriatic, and was doing really well, free of disease. But the motor weakness continued and never really improved. Here's Dr. Koo and her questions about this case.
I have had a patient with Lambert-Eaton who was treated as limited stage. We did PET scans, we did brain MRIs, couldn't find any recurrent disease, but she still had this weakness where she was seeing a neurologist, and it never really changed no matter what we did at that point.
And how did it manifest? Was it just weakness or sensory, or what was it?
It was mostly motor weakness. I'd be curious to know for Lambert-Eaton, what is the pathophysiology? If the patient presents with Lambert-Eaton, wanting to just get a better sense of how should it be managed? How should we be thinking about the course of the disease as we treat the underlying cancer? Does it even have any correlation with serving as a sign of relapse or not? Or should we even be expecting there's going to be residual long-lasting problems even after treating all of the cancer? I would be curious to know if doing checkpoint therapy and immunotherapy in general, how that affects paraneoplastic syndromes, since there is that overlap of autoimmune mechanism. I'd be wondering if it would be something that I'd have to manage with maybe with a rheumatologist, just to be safe that I'm not actually going to worsen the paraneoplastic syndrome.
So, Charlie, I remember the first time I saw the first-line IO trials, one of the first thoughts I had was, I wonder what happens if you give an IO to somebody with paraneoplastic syndrome. What do we know about that? And what do we know about Eaton-Lambert syndrome in terms of the pathophysiology? Is it kind of easy to make a diagnosis clinically, or could this patient have maybe some other issue going on?
Eaton-Lambert essentially presents like myasthenia. It is a weakness syndrome, and it's, of course, related to the antibodies against the acetylcholine receptor. So basically, same kind of pathophysiology we see as we see in myasthenic syndromes. It unfortunately is something where even if the disease is treated, it can really persist. So sometimes it goes away, and the right thing to do for the syndrome essentially is to treat the disease, to treat the cancer. It is a frustrating situation when the patient has essentially NED, but has persistent, neurologic deficits. And we've tried things like IVIG and all the things you can think of. Sometimes some benefit, but often these syndromes are pretty persistent. So unfortunately, this is something the patients end up kind of living with. I have a patient who's quite debilitated, essentially cured of cancer, but with a persistent neurologic problem. The question about whether we give checkpoint inhibitors in this context is a really good one. Of course, the checkpoint inhibitors are mostly stimulating the T cell side of the immune system, cytolytic T cells, CD8 positive T cells, whereas these syndromes, most of the paraneoplastics, are really humoral immunity syndromes. They're antibody mediated. I have given immunotherapy with caution in this sort of circumstance, and I don't know that there has been worsening of the neurologic syndromes. But it's certainly an understudied area. These patients are essentially excluded from the trials that looked at checkpoint inhibitors.
So, Stephen, anything you want to add to that? And I guess SIADH is one of the more common paraneoplastic syndromes. In general, Stephen, do you see syndromes like SIADH, correlating with tumor status a little better than what we saw here?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I think the endocrine neoplastic syndromes, whether it's SIADH or Cushing's, those often do track a bit with the state of the cancer, where you'll see that sodium go back up with that initial response. And then at the time of relapse, you might see it drop back down. So I would pay attention to those numbers. But like Charlie said, the neurologically antibody-mediated paraneoplastic syndromes, those often do not correlate well with the disease course. Now, in retrospective studies, a lot of older work do suggest those patients do better, have a better prognosis, but their quality of life is really impacted. And for many of these neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes, we don't have good treatments. I've been very disappointed by plasma exchange, IVIG. Things like for Lambert-Eaton syndrome, though, there is a drug. It's an expensive drug, but if you can get it covered, amifampridine, which is an oral agent that sort of increases acetylcholine release, should be effective for Lambert-Eaton. And so you take it 3 times a day. You may need to take it forever. But it really can improve the quality of life. So if it is Lambert-Eaton and you've got that proximal muscle weakness, that difficulty standing up from a seated position, this may be a case where you want to test for Lambert-Eaton syndrome. And if it's positive, think about giving a try for amifampridine.
So Maria in our chat room, somehow there's some kind of mental telepathy thing. She says, How would you treat EGFR lung cancer with histologic transformation? Maria, that's our next case. And, you know, we actually think about, we come a long way with EGFR disease from gefitinib. We spent an entire 2-hour CME program at ASCO just on EGFR mutant lung cancer. But now here's a case which, you know, is not rare in clinical practice. Patient with EGFR exon 19 deletion who gets osimertinib and unfortunately progressed at 11 months. Here's Dr. Rodriguez.
This is the last time that I celebrated with a patient that he had an EGFR mutation. He was going to do great. And about 11 months, he was progressing on osimertinib. So then we escalated the treatment with chemotherapy. We added carboplatin pemetrexed. And he just basically was not responding. He developed more back pain, developed brain mets that progressed. And then a repeat biopsy, because he was just progressing, one of the lesions in the sternum grew fast and big. So that kind of raised our suspicion that he was transforming to small cell carcinoma. And that happened to him. And really what I had expected him to have, a relatively easy course, became a very difficult course. How common is small cell transformation? Can it be prevented? Can we use all the small cell therapies to patients that transform from EGFR, or is it a different disease? Currently, a lot of these trials allow patients with small cell transformation. So if he had been with us today, we would have tried to put him in one of the trials for tarlatamab or a bispecific T-cell engager, because there's a whole set of new antibody drug conjugates that could potentially help these patients.
So, Stephen, I am curious about, you know, whether typical therapies used for small cell work with small cell transformation. And also, you know, people who progress on EGFR, TKI like osimertinib often will get liquid biopsies. How do you decide to go, you know, you really want to get tissue? What raises your suspicion? You see RB status or any sort of clues that this is happening? She mentioned this palpable lesion on the sternum, for example.
I think whenever you can do a biopsy, it's best to do it because there's not great markers. And, you know, while we do ctDNA very frequently, the detection of, you know, RB and P53 mutations is really neither sensitive nor specific for small cell transformation. We know that if you have P53 and RB at baseline, you have a much higher risk of eventual small cell transformation, maybe a 40-fold plus greater risk. But overall, it's still the minority. It's still estimated anywhere from 15%. Those numbers aren't super reliable just because we don't get as many biopsies as we'd like. But we did look, I think, at Charlie's institution, Dr. Helena Yu, looked at giving small cell specific chemotherapy, platinum etoposide, up front to try to kill off those clones maybe and see if you could prevent that small cell transformation. But unfortunately, it just didn't pan out. And I think it's just because we know the risk is there, but we don't have good enough drugs.
Charlie, any thoughts? Does tarlatamab work with transformed disease?
We don't know that yet, but I think it would be a reasonable strategy to try. What we do know about these transformed cases, they behave a lot like small cell lung cancer, but of course they have a much lower tumor mutation burden. They were EGFR mutant lung cancers, so they may be less responsive to checkpoint inhibitors. But the tarlatamab bypasses, you know, antigen presentation by directly engaging the T cell with DLL3 on the surface of the cancer cell. So I would be really interested to see what the response rate is for tarlatamab for patients like this. We don't have that answer, but I think it's something that is begging to be studied.
So one more quick case. I'm not sure how much there is to say, but I am curious what your thoughts are. We saw some years back this issue of trilaciclib. I just thought it was kind of cool. I was wondering if it was going to come into other tumors. But anyhow, here's Dr. Ku again with a 66-year-old lady, extensive stage disease, who got trilaciclib but still got grade 3 neutropenia. Here's Dr. Ku.
She presented with small cell lung cancer, at least stage T3 N2, and then also had a brain MRI showing 2 sub-3-millimeter lesions, and so probably some metastatic disease there, with symptoms of chest discomfort from a significant burden of disease with unilateral, hilar, and mediastinal nodal involvement. And she was started on carboplatin, etoposide, atezolizumab. She had a very good partial response radiographically, just a few hilar lymph nodes still enlarged, mildly FDG avid on PET scan. And even though she had a really good response, the treatment was somewhat difficult for her. She had neutropenia, afebrile, but still, even breaking through on the trilaciclib, that required additional G-CSF support to prevent repeated dose delays.
I'm curious what kind of experience you had with trilaciclib in small cell.
Yeah, I've used it in all my extensive stage small cells. Pretty much as soon as I heard about it, I was pretty early adopting. And I found it rare that I would have anyone break through. In fact, a lot of my staff, I had to teach them that in the trilaciclib trial, you could add G-CSF because they never had seen a breakthrough before.
Wow.
Well, yeah, so our patients do really well. I'm a believer of it. I'd be really interested in bone marrow suppression protection as a strategy in general.
So, Stephen, I didn't get a huge amount of enthusiasm for trilaciclib from the two of you when we were chatting before we got started. Curious what your thoughts are and whether or not this strategy in general throughout oncology, not necessarily this drug, but you think there's any value in it, or maybe it's sort of part of the old school, so to speak.
I think there's potential value. It's a fascinating concept, you know, blocking CDK4/6 in this setting, particularly where you have a tumor that's a little less cell cycle dependent. We did see that it reduced the rate of severe neutropenia. I think there's no question, and it's a good supportive medication. There are costs involved with it, and I think it's reasonable to use. I think what's really fascinating, though, is you know, while we think from a safety standpoint, it's nice to preserve neutrophils and platelets, one wonders if could this, you know, preserve some of the T cells that eventually are important for improved efficacy. And that's not been shown, but it's, I think it's a very interesting potential rationale to use the drug.
That is really an interesting thought. Charlie?
Yeah, I agree. It's not a drug that we honestly use very much, but it is effective at protecting the marrow. It hasn't been shown to improve survival for small cell lung cancer patients. But if it allows, you know, retention of counts and avoidance of infection, that's certainly a good thing. It does come with a cost and some toxicities with it as well. I do think the idea that it might augment immunotherapy is a really interesting one, and again, I think is ripe for investigation. That would really, I think, drive people to want to use this drug more. I would say, you know, neutropenia this is a disease that can affect the marrow. You know, it can infiltrate the marrow. In fact, we used to do bone marrow biopsies back in the distant day to sort of stage this disease. Marrow involvement can definitely be problematic, and that may be the case in the particular case described.
All right. Well, that's kind of a warm up for the big stories here. I pulled several papers from ASCO and another one from another meeting that we're going to start out with at the end of the conference. We have a bunch of other papers, which I don't think we'll get all to, but the audience can check out those. But let's get into the ones. This one wasn't as talked about, Stephen, but I found it very interesting, you know, kind of a trying to repeat what was seen with durvalumab in limited stage disease, now using atezolizumab. And interestingly, is the trial was negative. I mean, it's not the first time we've seen a negative trial with one IO and a positive one with another. And there have been a couple that have been atezolizumab and other tumors. I'm not sure what that exactly means. So, Stephen, again, when we look back at the Adriatic study, same strategy, now durvalumab, you see a benefit in terms of survival as well as progression-free survival. Any thoughts about why this atezo study was negative, Stephen?
A bit of a surprise. As you mentioned, with Adriatic, the use of immunotherapy after chemo radiation, 0.73 survival hazard ratio, very robust improvement in survival. And one would expect this would translate to really all checkpoint inhibitors because we think they're fairly interchangeable. Are they interchangeable? Are there some differences? They are different drugs, and it's hard to know if that really accounts for these results, which I think were very surprising. But when you asked Dr. Gromberg himself, why did we see such different results here? His answer was really that the radiation was very different. This was BID radiation. This was a radiation fractionation strategy that many people do think is superior. And with more aggressive, intense radiation therapy, were the outcomes overall better. When you look at that Gromberg study, the control arm did particularly well. The experimental arm did very similar in terms of landmark OS and PFS rates as Adriatic. It was really that control arm that outperformed. And is that because the radiation strategy was better? And should we be exploring twice daily radiation in more of our patients? And I will say it's something that we are doing more at Georgetown.
Charlie, any thoughts? Also, you know, there are people cured with limited stage disease just by chemo radiation. Any suggestion that at least with durvalumab, there's more of a plateau, maybe increased cure rate, or is it too early to say?
I think it's a little early to say, but I expect there will be. In extensive stage disease, there's a survival benefit for the addition of immunotherapy, and some of those responses are truly transformative. We should see that as well in these curves. This is a little bit, you know, immature in terms of the full extent of these curves, but I think, you know, these are hanging up nicely. I don't think atezolizumab is a different drug, particularly than durvalumab. I think there are some differences in the study. One being that the trial that was presented at ASCO is phase two. The Adriatic is phase three, and a much larger study, a much more robust powered study for outcome. So, you know, phase two doesn't always predict phase three. Sometimes we get it go the other way. But in this case, I think the phase two may have given us the wrong answer, actually, and the phase three is more dependable in terms of a conclusion.
That's a really good thought. Stephen, you know, now we got a bunch of people with non-small cell, particularly with high PD-1 levels with metastatic disease, are alive, doing well at 5 years. I don't know if we have enough follow-up at this point with IO as first-line therapy. Have you seen small cell patients who survive 5 years
with extensive disease? Yeah, I have. And, you know, while it's really not many, and certainly not as many as we'd like, we do see it. And those are patients when they come to clinic, and frankly, they don't come to clinic all that often, but we make sure every fellow gets a chance to see them and talk with them just to reinforce that it is possible and that is the ceiling. And I think that's really the goal now. We want that for more people, though.
So we're going to get into the next two papers. Really look like they're shifting approach to first and second line therapy of small cell. So it's a practice changing ASCO for small cell. Here's the first paper, the so-called IMforte trial, now adding in lurbinectinib to atezolizumab as maintenance therapy after chemo IO. And Charlie, you know, we see progression-free survival benefit from LURB, as well as a survival benefit. More, you know, chemo-like side effects, particularly cytopenias, as you would imagine, bringing in chemotherapy in the maintenance setting. And I know, like in the discussant, they said, and therefore, I don't know the exact words, but that maintenance with IO plus lurbinectinib, she didn't exactly say standard of care, but is something to consider in specific patients. So I guess the one thing I've been hearing, Charlie, people talk about is, you know, okay, if the patient has a really hard time with chemo, they're very beat up, they have a lot of symptoms, maybe you want to hold off on the lurbinectinib and, you know, go to tarlatamab and maybe come to lurbinectinib later. But what about for the younger patient who gets through chemotherapy well, Charlie? Is this something you would bring up to the patient as an option?
Yeah, Neil, I think you're exactly right. For the patient that is a little bit beat up, this certainly would not be a great option. You know, I think those patients need a bit of a break, honestly, from cytotoxic therapy. It's hard to know what to do exactly with this trial because the patients who were enrolled in this trial, most of them never got lurbinectedin if they were on the control arm. So, you know, it's bringing lurbinectedin, which is a very active agent, a good chemotherapy drug. We use it a lot in small cell, into maintenance, but without the ability of the patients on the control arm to get it later. So it's really early second line in my mind, bringing in a cytotoxic on top of maintenance immunotherapy. And so it's hard to know whether it's really better than waiting and holding that drug for when you need it down the line.
Again, Stephen, we see here also this is now published in The Lancet. So if you want to read that and get into their discussion in terms of what they think this means. Any thoughts about this, Stephen? Is, you know, It was pointed out that not everybody gets the second line therapy. And whether you look at this as maintenance or early second line therapy, again, maybe leave something to discuss with the patient, and at least let them become involved. How are you thinking about bringing this into your practice, Stephen?
Yeah, I think that you can't discount the survival advantage. When we think of what we're doing, we're taking an active drug. Like Charlie said, lurbinectedin is an active agent. We use it in the later line setting. We're moving it up. And so before the study's even done, you expect to improve progression for your survival modestly and to come at the cost of toxicity. And the real question is, does it prolong survival? And here, I think showing an OS hazard ratio of 0.73 says that, yeah, it improves survival. And I think, you really hit the main point there, is that if you wait till progression, most studies, including this one, including 133, including other phase 3 trials, show that only about half the people that progress get second line therapy. It's because when this cancer progresses, it often does so in an unforgiving, in a violent way. And if we wait until progression, often people have no opportunity to get benefit. So we want to move our drugs earlier. I agree that this is just moving an agent before progression. Other maintenance trials in the past have not shown an OS benefit. I think it has to show an OS benefit to even be considered. And this does show an OS benefit. So I think if patients meet the criteria in the study, it was patients that did not have progression and still had a good performance status after induction, then I do think that this is something we offer. But a reminder that when you give this drug with atezolizumab, lurbinectedin, every 3 weeks, you are giving primary prophylaxis with GCSF.
Yeah, I would say, the survival benefit is limited, and there doesn't appear to be a tail on the curve in terms of raising the tail, which is really, I think, the ultimate goal we want.
I think they also mentioned that I think 75% of the patients who started out by the time they got to the maintenance phase were still eligible in terms of responding. So, most patients would be considered for this, and again, seems like it'd be very individualized. So that's part one, which is the potential of LURB moving into the first line. And part two, Charlie presented the Delphi 304 study, now looking at tarlatamab second line, very much anticipated. So before we get into the actual data, can you just sort of refresh our memory about DLL3, Charlie? When you think about it as a target, it seems almost ideal in that I guess you see it in almost all small cell and very little normal tissue?
Yeah, it's expressed in almost all small cell lung cancers. And it happens to be a direct transcriptional target of a transcription factor called ASCL1, which is a driver of small cell. So it really gets upregulated about a millionfold over what it is expressed in any other normal adult tissue. And because of that, it becomes cell surface expressed. So it becomes a target, and a very unique target on the cancer cell, really not expressed on any other adult tissues.
And Stephen, when I first heard about tarlatamab, I was thinking, wow, CD3 bispecific, because we, of course, have been hearing a general oncologist know all about this from myeloma and lymphoma. There are a lot of CD3 bispecific, very effective drugs, but again, tolerability in terms of cytokine release syndrome, ICANS, the same kind of thing you see with CAR T therapy. And we'll talk about how it's actually playing out in practice, because I guess one of the really fascinating things about this study was actually the toxicity was less in the tarlatamab trial than in the chemo trial. And I thought this kind of an extra perk that at least I wasn't necessarily expecting. We did see that there was a survival benefit there, hazard rate of 0.47 or around 0.4, progression-free survival benefit as well, a hazard rate of 0.71. I always, you rarely see patient-reported symptomatology. So interesting is this. I mean, you can really see the benefits clinically to these patients. So, Charlie, any thoughts about the efficacy that was observed here in terms of PFS over survival, and particularly the fact that you can pick up, patient-reported difference in outcomes?
Yeah, no, I think this was a striking part of the study. Of course, the primary endpoint, overall survival, we were excited to see, but we also want our patients to live better lives as well as longer lives, and that really read out here, I think. And I think clinically we see that. This drug has substantial toxicities in the first couple rounds of treatment, but most patients after that have less side effects than they would on chemotherapy. So if you can get through those first couple weeks, it's actually a great drug.
Incidentally, what were the second or the control arm choices there? You know, LERB was one of them, and topotecan, et cetera, but how did it actually break out, and was there any difference?
Yeah, so most of the patients on the control arm got topotecan. Patients in countries that where lurbinectedin was available often got lurbinectedin. That was the U.S., Canada, South Korea, maybe a couple of other, Australia. But most of the patients didn't have access necessarily to lurbinectedin. And then in Japan, amrubicin was allowed. It was essentially dealer's choice of chemotherapy among the standard of care options.
So we'll talk more about how torlatumab actually plays out in a practice, but the safety profile and, you know, what your description was kind of surprised me. I thought it was going to be more of a problem. It sort of reminded me, we were talking about bispecific lymphoma and myeloma. There's a drug that our audience is familiar with, mosunetuzumab in follicular lymphoma, that seems like it's getting close to being used as an outpatient, community-based docs. And I wonder, I mean, Stephen, do you think that that maybe, we'll talk later on about the ins and outs of giving tarlatamab, but can you see a day when a community-based oncologist is going to start tarlatamab, Stephen?
Yeah, I think that day's today. I really think that, you know, the efficacy here is very robust and we shouldn't be afraid to give this drug, but it does require some changes in infrastructure. I think if you're used to giving these CAR-T drugs, you're used to dealing with CRS and ICANS. But if you're not, while the overall toxicities are less common, they're different toxicities. It's not chemotherapy tox. So I think it takes some experience. It takes sort of the right setting. But the goal has to be to roll this out to all hospitals, to all practitioners.
I was mentioning, Charlie, we have presented a case, again, an oncologist presented a case of using mosunetuzumab, and she did what we hear the investigators doing when she gave the patient steroids to take home. The patient called her, said, I've got a fever. She said, take the steroids. The patient didn't even come in. Do you foresee a day like that when you'll treat low-grade CRS, you know, without even bringing the patient in?
I do. It is important that they be in a context where they can be fairly closely monitored. But we're really, I think, hospital at home kind of approaches are a reality. You know, now with, you know, remote sensing, we can actually follow people's vitals. I think for this drug and others like it, we're going to be pushing hard to figure out how to give these drugs safely as an outpatient from day one.
So we're going to move on now and get into some cases where these strategies are brought up. Just to mention also that this paper, the Delphi study, was also published. This one's in the New England Journal. Again, I really recommend that you check it out, including the discussion. Also to check out the discussion by Dr. Meter of these papers that we're talking about. We're not going to go through all the points that she made, but just to let you know, great presentation. She talked about all the new trials that are coming out with tarlatamab. And also, again, this sort of new paradigm for small cell where lurbinectedin is a consideration up front. Tarlatamab, people are saying now, standard second line. And then they don't get lurbinectedin up front. Maybe they could have it considered third line. Just one more point about this so-called tri-specific that was phase two was reported at ASCO, Charlie, and you know, pretty good hazard, pretty good waterfall plot. Any comments on like what the three things are? That I mean, I know one of them CD3, but like, what's the idea here, Charlie? And you think it's going to be better than a bispecific?
We'll see. So so this is a molecule that binds twice on DLL3, so it has two different domains of DLL3 that it's binding to. Maybe to increase the affinity, and then it also, of course, binds to the T cell CD3. This is a small trial; it's 24 patients, so it's a little hard to stack it up against, say, tarlatamab. At this point, it looks good. It looks good, but we'll have to see how it plays out. The question is it really better, or is it going to end up being a me too? We'll see.
So one more paper/agent I want to get your take on. And actually, when we think back, to me, when I think back to the beginning of the sort of new age of small cell, one of the things I think about was the study that Charlie did on the DLL3 antibody-drug conjugate, so-called ROVA-T, that really never played out, I think, because it was very toxic. But at least the study was done. It was kind of like, to me, the first idea that maybe, you know, we're going to be see some of these new agents in the small cell that we saw in non-small cell. So, Stephen, what about IDXD? Obviously, we have a number of agents with a DXD payload. Can you talk about the B7H3 target of this ADC and whether you think that maybe this agent, and again, this is presented at the Japanese Society of Medical Oncology, this a study of ifinatamab, deruxtecan, and at least, you know, initially it looks like, you know, again, pretty good waterfall plot. It seems to be tolerable. I'm curious, Stephen, what your thoughts are about this ADC and other ADCs in small cell.
I think ADCs are going to have a clear role in this disease. I think that the IDA-Lung1 study, which I think Charlie actually presented initially at WCLC, these data, this is sort of an important update we saw in Japan. But this is looking at two different doses. We saw the higher dose had a little bit more activity. I think that's the one we're going forward with. There are some toxicities with it, but the responses are robust. And B7H3 is a good target. It's, unlike DLL3, not just for small cell lung cancer. It may have a role in non-small cell lung cancer as well. And we do see it even in EGFR, for example. So I think that there's a lot of potential applications. But by pushing up that drug-antibody ratio, by selectively introducing the cytotoxic where the target is, we can have a sort of a larger therapeutic window and maybe disrupt the architecture of these tumors where maybe they make better partners for immunotherapy. So, Neil, I think there's a future where maybe these ADCs replace frontline chemotherapy, maybe as better partners with immunotherapy. We have to see. Those studies need to be done. And while IDXD is the farthest along, there are a slew of other ADCs with different targets that I think are going to make a difference for this disease.
I mean, triple-negative breast cancer as of ASCO, now first-line therapy is going to be an ADC, sacituzumab plus an IO, and another study positive, just sacituzumab. So bladder cancer, we have IO and fortimab, ADC and fortimab plus an IO. Charlie, any other thoughts about this agent, particularly toxicity? People see the DXD payload, and they think about ILD, although I'm not sure how much has to do with the payload or, in the case of TDXD, the HER2 targeting, you know, being in the lung. Also, the, you know, one thing that was kind of a surprise about TDXD was the acute GI issues, nausea and vomiting. I'm curious whether you see that with IDXD as well. How is it tolerated, and did you see any useful responses?
Oh, we certainly see responses, and I agree with Stephen. I think these drugs have a real future in small cell lung cancer and may ultimately be able to displace first-line chemotherapy. They do have toxicities, and like all of the DXD drugs, all the ones with deruxtecan warheads, whether it's TROP2, whether it's HER3, whether it's HER2, whether it's whatever it is, we see it at about 5 to 15% of the patients have interstitial lung disease, reactions. And these can be problematic. So it is a toxicity we see with this drug, but I think the benefit is looking like it outweighs the risk, and we'll see how it plays out. But we're excited about this class of drugs.
So before we go on, Stephen, Robert in the chat room, thanks, Robert, because I wanted to ask this question. I forgot to ask it. It's an obvious question. Getting back to the Inforte study is, what about the patient who gets started on Durva, you know, chemo Durva? Would you add LURB to Durva?
Yeah, I think that conceptually, I don't see much difference between the drugs. And so the benefit, I would think, would extend regardless of the PD-L1. I'd be very comfortable adding lurbinectedin if someone was receiving durvalumab. The only caveat is whether insurance or payers would have a say. Hopefully they wouldn't. The decision makers, I think, should be the physicians. So scientifically, I don't really see any difference.
Well, I mean, plus there's kind of a fine line between early second-line therapy and continuing the IO and maintenance. So hopefully people are able to do what they think is best for patients. All right, here we go with some other cases that are really going to tie into these data sets and how they're in practice. So any case that starts out 85-year-old man with mild dementia and small cell always gets my attention is going to be an interesting experience. This patient, like a number of cases I heard from these docs, had limited stage disease and then relapsed before they were even, while they were still in maintenance, so durvalumab, but with brain mets. And wow, I heard so many cases like this and just brain mets in general with small cell. Of course, we know that, but just hearing the cases was pretty dramatic. Here's Dr. Rudolph.
He was getting his maintenance durvalumab, and about 4 months into it, he started developing worsening confusion, at which point a brain MRI was performed and unfortunately showed multiple brain metastases. So he was referred for whole brain radiation therapy, unfortunately, because based upon my discussion with the radiologist, they did not think they could do SBRT to the multiple lesions.
Any questions for the faculty?
If we're doing whole brain radiation therapy, are we now routinely in the academic centers using memantine to prevent memory loss? I have not preemptively given this to my patients, and I don't know if the radoncs are routinely doing this, not the ones at least in where I practice. I'd love to know how the academic centers are handling this. It reportedly in studies it has shown to prevent neurocognitive decline. I'd love to know if they've actually seen that in the real world setting. And then lastly, other than hippocampal avoidance and memantine, which are both of them are used to decrease the chances of neurocognitive decline, what else can we do in these patients to prevent further memory loss?
In terms of questions for the faculty, you raised the issue of if he stabilizes, would lurbinectin be a reasonable option? What's your experience been with LURB?
I have used lurbinectin in 3 or 4 patients in the past, and they actually did very well. Had some cytopenias, neutropenia in particular, but no real side effects otherwise. I've had patients on it for up to close to a year, doing extremely well. I have liked it as a treatment option. It definitely is better than topotecan, and I think it definitely has much higher efficacy than the chemotherapies of the past.
Charlie, any thoughts about her questions and comments? And also the issue, of course, this is before we saw the data from ASCO, but the issue of giving tarlatamab to a patient who already has a mild dementia, to patients who have symptomatic brain mets. How are you going to figure out whether they have ICANS or not? Any thoughts?
Yeah, this is a difficult situation. 85-year-old with multiple brain metastases and dementia on top of it. I mean, this is clearly a situation where, you know, a good conversation with the patient and the family is warranted. You know, we do use memantine some to try to reduce the toxicity of radiation, of brain radiation. I would say it may have some impact. I think that impact is more measurable on neurocognitive testing than in real life, in terms of sort of how patients feel and do. Of course, whole brain radiation is going to be associated with fatigue and the potential for worsening neurocognitive function. There's no great answer here. I think, you know, lurbinectedin is a reasonable agent and a good drug. I totally agree. Another drug that I consider sometimes in patients where they have primary disease in the brain is actually temozolomide. You know, it was originally approved for brain tumors. It has pretty good activity in small cell lung cancer, similar response rate to other chemos, and has really good CNS penetration. So I would consider that part of my equation.
So a quick follow-up question from Marie in the chat room. Charlie, how active is tarlatamab in the CNS?
That's a great question. We don't have full data on that yet, but we know that it does have activity. And in fact, in the 304 trial that we talked about earlier, we did amend that trial to allow patients with asymptomatic brain metastases untreated to enroll on study. So there is CNS activity with the drug.
All right, let's move on to another case. This is from Dr. Gupta. younger patient, 59-year-old man, extensive stage disease. Again, rapid progression while on first-line therapy. Here's Dr. Gupta.
This is a 59-year-old African-American man. He was a smoker. I saw him as an inpatient. He presented with SVC syndrome in 2024. He had extensive liver mets, solitary brain mets, for which we did gamma knife. And he was extremely sick. He was very symptomatic from his disease. He had severe cough. So we gave him first-line carbo, etoposide, and atezolizumab. The first chemo was given as an inpatient, did not get atezo along with that during the hospitalization. And atezo was added with the second cycle. He did very well. Clinically, he did very well. His cough resolved. His swelling in the neck resolved completely. We did a scan which showed a very favorable response. But as we were planning to do two more cycles of treatment, he became symptomatic again. We re-imaged him and he had severe progression of disease. So he's kind of platinum resistant because he developed a progression of disease. While on first line treatment, he had adenopathy, liver mets, pleural effusion, new bone mets, SVC syndrome. And this time he had severe cytopenias. He required blood transfusion. And we decided to go with tarlatamab. He had severe cytopenias and lubrinectedin is a chemo, right? So it causes more myelosuppression. So I think one of the questions that we struggled with when he had progression of disease is what is the most appropriate second-line treatment in extensive stage small cell lung cancer? Would it be the lubrinectedin or tarlatamab? Are there any specific reasons why we will choose one over the other? And in the ASCO, there was the phase 3 IM-40 trial that was presented showing benefit of maintenance lubrinectedin and atezo versus atezo in, you know, early stage, limited stage small cell lung cancer. Would that change the landscape if we are going to use lubrinectedin in the maintenance setting?
So, Stephen, I'm waiting for the day that immunotherapy is going to get we'll be able to give it in the hospital. To me, it's incredible that you still can't do that. I'm curious, before we get into the issue, how you decide on second-line therapy. We did a program a few weeks ago with Ben Levy, and I brought up to him a case. Actually, I had just taken the boards in oncology, and this came up on the three-month thing, you know? I don't want to say exactly what it was. But the issue was, and this case is a good example of first-line treatment of small cell when you have SVC syndrome, and do you always need to go with radiation therapy? They have a lot of systemic disease, and the SVC is not that bad. How do you decide whether to start chemo or radiation, Stephen? And any comments about second-line therapy in this kind of situation?
SVC syndrome is a little bit more common in small cell because this is a more central tumor. And, it's a tumor that progresses pretty quickly. And so often it's a little different from what you see in non-small cell, where maybe it's a little bit slower and you have more collaterals. It's a little more fulminant in small cell. But really your management, I think, depends on your pretest probability of response. And, you know, one thing about small cell lung cancer is, at least initially, it's very sensitive to chemotherapy. And generally, we don't do radiation. I feel like I can get a response quicker with chemotherapy than radiation can. So often we'll start with chemotherapy and we see responses fairly quickly. Whereas in non-small cell, the responses to chemotherapy are not quite as robust. There, I do think radiation plays a much bigger role. In terms of your second question, the standard second-line treatment, you know, while, as Charlie mentioned, most of the patients in the Delphi study received topotecan in the control arm, I think it's pretty clear that tarlatamab is the standard of care in the second-line setting. To me, this is the drug we should be using second-line. If you were to receive lurbinectedin in the maintenance setting as IM-40, then tarlatamab would still be the option at the time of progression. The only barriers to tarlatamab use in that second line are really pragmatic, practical, or access.
So I want you to listen to this next case of a patient who got tarlatamab and had ICANS. I know it's not very common, but this is a 66-year-old woman who got carboplatin and atezo, radiation therapy, maintenance atezo, then got lurbinectinib, finally got tarlatamab. Here's what happened.
Her job was to be a trainer. She was working in a gym. When her face started getting swollen, she actually had kind of the characteristics of SVC syndrome, was found to have a right upper lobe mass of like about 7 × 10 centimeters, so a very large mass, was admitted to the hospital. She had a EBUS biopsy that shows small cell lung cancer. She had extensive disease outside the chest. She was treated by another physician. They did carboplatin, etoposide, atezolizumab. She did well initially, but then started relapsing in the brain. And the question was, should we go to lurbinectedin next, or should we start her on tarlatamab? She had a really good performance status, so we thought that she should get tarlatamab first. She actually did well initially in the first cycle. In the second cycle, I got a phone call on the weekend from the hospital that she was very disoriented. And this patient was definitely confused, and those symptoms resolved quickly. I can, in patients with brain mets, it's very complicated because this lady had brain mets and had radiation with SRS at least twice. So the patient went on to receive her second cycle, had some improvement, but after cycle 4, she developed further decline, a lot of fatigue, and increasing symptoms related to progression in the back. So she didn't really have a long response to tarlatamab, unfortunately. She already had had lurbinectedin. We had a conversation about topotecan and irinotecan, and by that time, the patient was very tired and fatigued, and the family opted to not pursue further care.
Anything else you want to hear discussed about her case?
I do think that part of the toxicity that she had, the fatigue, was really traveling. She had to travel for about an hour to then wait there for 10 hours after her second cycle. And then it's not until cycle 4 that these observations get reduced. And the treatment lasts less than 20 minutes. And you're just sitting there for 10 hours or 8 hours. So it's a big time commitment. And that adds to not only the time toxicity for the patient, but also for the caregivers.
So, Charlie, any thoughts about this case? When you see ICANS, is this typical? And how easy is it to pick it up? How do the brain mets make it more difficult? You know, with CAR T, they have all these questions you're supposed to ask patients to try to pick it up early. So, any comments about ICANS?
Yeah, I think the case that Dr. Rodriguez presented is exactly, is sort of one that we worry about a lot, which is, patients who have brain mets, it is very difficult to sort out what's drug toxicity, what's disease toxicity, what's radionecrosis toxicity, and what's the interaction between those in patients who are often, elderly as well. So it can be very difficult to sort out. And ICANS, as you know, is kind of a diagnosis of exclusion. That is, if you don't have another good reason the patient is confused, then we say it's ICANS. So it's a difficult diagnosis. And it sounds like the patient had a transient event, which would be consistent with ICANS, got better from that, ultimately died of disease.
Stephen, anything you want to add to that, what your experience has been with tarlatamab, and also this issue of these prolonged observation periods? I mean, again, actually, there's less toxicity in the tarlatamab arm than the chemo arm. And in spite of that, these patients, as she points out, really go through a lot in terms of trying to do this observation. Where do you see that heading? And any comments about what you've seen, Stephen, with ICANS?
Yeah, we've seen a few cases of ICANS, not that many, fortunately. CRS, I think, is quite common. But over time, you become more comfortable with it. But the point that Dr. Rodriguez brought up about the time toxicity is a real one. And if you go by the package insert, which a lot of sites will do, it's a 23-hour, it's an overnight observation, the first 2 weeks, and then it goes to 8 hours for the next, really three doses. After that, 3 to 4 hours for two cycles, and then 2-hour observation. But an 8-hour observation period, for those of us that have to manage infusion centers, we got to turn that chair over 2 or 3 times to be viable. So to have people sitting there for 8 hours, there are real consequences, and we need to rethink our workflow there. I do think that some of those requirements for observation are a little too conservative, and I think over time probably impractical. And over time, I do think this moves to outpatient with less observation. When we think of CRS that we've seen, it's been pretty consistent, Neil. We dose the patient, and just like clockwork, about 12 hours later is when you see that CRS, you see that fever. So I like not to time it up around lunchtime because then I get called in the middle of the night. I'd rather give it earlier in the morning if we can. But generally, that first dose, we see a little bit of fever. You step up to 10 milligrams. And the next dose, we see also some CRS, but generally the fever is a little bit lower. And then it takes a little bit longer. And hopefully by the third dose, you stop seeing it.
So I was trying not to ask about this issue of giving IOs in the morning versus in the afternoon, but now I'm going to have to bring it up because we saw more data on that at ASCO, Charlie. Also in the chat room, Charlie Shale brings up a good question. I brought up this issue earlier of maybe patients could go to tarlatamab without getting maintenance LRB. Do we know anything about response to LRB after tarlatamab?
So first of all, that was probably the most fascinating presentation at ASCO that I heard. It was really dramatic difference in terms of outcome. I don't have a great explanation for it, for a drug that, you know, has a half-life measured in weeks. But there must be some kind of infusion, peak level that affects things. I don't have a scientific explanation for it, but it was not a subtle difference. I think it needs to be confirmed.
It was randomized,
controlled trial. Well done. I my hat's off to the investigators, and I think we need to confirm that result with another trial. But it's really striking. So, I don't know what to do with that. I can't treat all my patients at 8 in the morning. You know, I can't have them all be done by 3 in the afternoon. But the data would sort of suggest that might be a better strategy. The other question you asked, now it's out of my mind.
Lurbinectedin
response after tarlatamab. Yeah. So I don't think we have great data on that, honestly. I would expect that the response rate would be very similar to what we've seen with lurbinectedin in other contexts. No reason to think that tarlatamab would induce resistance to a cytotoxic. So I would expect, you know, the response rate of 35% that we've seen in other studies.
So I'm not going to go into this next case, but it's interesting that this is a patient who actually got a bite. This wasn't tarlatamab, a different one in development. We saw a couple of them, I think, at ASCO with LRB, and the patient actually is on that protocol right now and doing well, which kind of leads me to the real question. And as I mentioned, there's a whole bunch of great ASCO papers at the end of the slide deck if anybody wants to check it out in the chat room. But I've got to ask, because this sort of popped into my mind, Stephen, any predictions about how we're going to be treating small cell like in 2 years? You think tarlatamab is going to end up as part of induction, part of maintenance? Where do you think LRB is going to come in? Any new agents, IDXD in maintenance setting? Any predictions?
I would predict that when we look at these T-cell engagers, they're powerful, but they seem to work better when there's lower disease burden because you have a better ratio of molecule to target. So my prediction, if I'm being bold, ADC plus checkpoint inhibitor followed by tarlatamab maintenance. I think that's a strategy that we might see pop up. I don't know about 2 years.
How do you like that, Charlie?
I like that. I think that is where the field is going. I think 2 years is optimistic, but I think we're heading in that direction.
So, Charlie and Stephen, thank you so much. This hour just flew by. I think we could have spent 2 hours talking about this, but hopefully people at least know what some of the issues are. And audience, thank you so much. Have a great day. Thanks so much, Stephen. Thanks, Charlie.
Absolutely.
See you later.